Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. If you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of what you think of a network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedom's Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right. Lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we dispose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, we thank you so very much for your time that you spent preambling here and giving us our good disclaimer. John will be joining us shortly. This evening's call is, the subject line is personam jurisdiction. As you know, we have on the Saturday call with Bernie about how to get to a place where you're judgment proof. In other words, there's nothing they can take away from you simply because you don't own anything. It's all in different trusts, properly assembled, properly arranged trusts that they can't pierce. As long as you don't violate the two tenets of those trusts, which is never commingle taxable money with money that goes into these trusts, number one, and number two, never utilize these trusts for anything that's criminal. As long as you don't do those two things, they're not going to be pierced. With that having been said, you have the perfect way to operate your life for the benefit of your religious society, which is yourself and anyone else that you choose to include in that religious society, whatever that religious value is in your life. It might be Christianity, it might be Judaism, it might be agnosticism, might be atheism, might be Satan worship. It's still all a religious society according to the Internal Revenue Service, and that's the litmus test that we operate under with regards to these tax matters. And then, of course, we've got on the Monday night call that we have GW, and he's showing you what to do, how to protect your flesh and blood, meaning that when you correct your status, you're moving from being property in a franchise of the United States to what you were to begin with, which was a Union State citizen or an American national. And so we have those two things in play. Now, Tuesday's call, tonight's call with John, is that he's going to show you how that can be leveraged either way for your benefit. And particularly tonight, he will be talking on something called personam jurisdiction. You have territorium jurisdiction, and you have personam jurisdiction. So tonight's on personam jurisdiction. And while I have everyone's attention here, and I'll be repeating this when we get to the Q&A part, very important, I encourage you all to join us tomorrow night with a new first-time speaker. And what this new speaker is offering is in harmony and augments what Bernie does on his Saturday calls. And that is, he offers a turnkey business operation with its EIN number and all that pertains to it so that you can operate tax neutral in your business. Now, you say, well, I'm not a business. I work for Publix or I work for whatever. Okay. Well, how about if you were to become that LLC that that business hires instead of hiring you. And, again, there's all sorts of benefits. You need to be on this call tomorrow night, if for no other reason than to welcome them, and for other reasons as well, to learn something and put another arrow in your quiver. So with this all having been said, it's my sincere pleasure to turn this call over to Brother John. Go ahead, buddy.
Hi, good evening. Thank you very much for your kind introduction there. Tonight, we're going to do a 40,000-foot view on jurisdiction, and we're going to cover a lot of the types of jurisdictions. One thing that's very important to understand is that the concept of jurisdiction means you are either pleading your case before the right person to hear it, and I'll use that term, person to hear it, or you're being accused in the correct place to hear it. And if a magistrate or a judge or a commissioner or arbitrator is not technically, if it's not their jurisdiction, technically anything you do in there is null and void. There is no, there cannot be an outcome. To that end, if they think that they've challenged you with something, whether it's a lawsuit or a traffic ticket or a violation of your septic system or whatever, it's important to that you understand the foundational basis and the concept of jurisdiction, so that if there's a challenge there that they are levying against you, that you can determine, yes, I am under that jurisdiction, or no, I am not. And G.W. spends his life, pours out his blood and his love and his tissue samples and his sweat and everything, trying to help individuals establish their correct jurisdiction. And not just establish it, because technically most of your jurisdictional issues have never changed. You still have the original jurisdiction, but there's a time that when if somebody accuses you of something, or you owe me a nickel, and you don't respond in a certain amount of time frame, it's believed and accepted as a fact. So what's very, very important is that if somebody says, you owe me a nickel, it's very, very important that you respond and say, hey, I don't owe you that nickel. What makes you think I owe you that nickel? And so in certain cases, a mere accusation can create a situation where somebody that you didn't count on shows up and appears with quote unquote jurisdiction. And so it's very, very important to understand. Now, a moment ago, Michael talked about different types of jurisdiction. The two that are, that GW works with the most is, personal or in personam jurisdiction and territorial jurisdiction. Now, the one thing about personal or in personam jurisdiction, which means in the proper person, or in your person is validly being addressed. In personam jurisdiction means that they have jurisdiction over you wherever you are at. There are no exceptions, not when it comes to in personam jurisdiction. If you're a U.S. citizen, and you, or if you're a French citizen or a Russian citizen, especially if you're a Russian citizen, regardless of what country you visit, they still have jurisdiction over you. There are countries that say that we won't extradite an individual from this country or from France or Venezuela or Portugal. They use the term non-extradition countries. The Russians have, I shouldn't use the specific country because almost every country out there has some of the idiosyncrasies and quirks of that jurisdiction, meaning that, whether you've renounced it or not, some of them, if you, were born in Argentina, they have certain claims that they carry to death, regardless of what other, citizenship or jurisdiction that you think you have. My wife is one of those people. She was born in Argentina and raised in Uruguay, and we've discovered some very interesting jurisdictional issues about that. When you're an aggregate person, air breathing, red blood in your veins, a heart pumping, person with cognitive thought, the Declaration of Independence identifies and says we hold these truths to be self-evident that individuals are endowed with certain inalienable rights by their creator. And to that end, that is a jurisdiction also. We actually recently, about 3.5 years ago, had a case in San Diego, California, where the state superior court yielded in a court case, saying, we explained to you, Your Honor, this is the covenant that under with which this relationship was established. This is not a corporation. These individuals do not have a marriage license. And to that end, for those of you who may question that, a license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal. And we'll play the devil's advocate or the judge's advocate here for a moment. And if somebody says, well, what do you mean you don't have a marriage license? Well, Your Honor, a license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal, correct? Oh, yeah. Well, you mean if I don't have that license, I can't get married? And marriage licenses are less than 163 years old, the licenses themselves. In here in the States. Before that, in fuel law in England, something that was carried over to the States is that it allowed entities from two different, or individuals from two different entities, meaning owned entities, to be joined. And the product of that relationship was property of the landowner. This is feudal law in England. And the same thing occurred in the 1800s and allowed property from two different plantations to be joined, i.e. wed, married, but the product of that relationship was property of the state. And that's also coincidentally why they can take a third of your assets when one dies or another, because you have a marriage license. Before that, marriages, births, deaths were all recorded in for over 400 or 300 years, were all recorded in on parchment, or that was put in the family Bible, or it was recorded in the family Bible for the last 182 years before that. But what's happening is that the state has made certain claims and things that, well, if you have this or you have that, we'll recognize that. And that includes a marriage license and a birth certificate. The birth certificate are held by the county clerk in the Hall of Records indicate that that individual is property of the state. We have a lot of individuals that for many, many years we've been working with hundreds of individuals, and actually now it's in the thousands, where families that when a child is born, we get an affidavit from the midwife and any other attendees there, two witnesses, and we sign it in the family Bible, and we put the birth on this such and such a date. This son or daughter was born to this couple, him being the son or of this husband and this wife, and they are being the husbands of this. And we go back four generations, and the same with on the wife's side, and, you know. And we put it in a newspaper, and we don't just put it in one. We put it in a minimum of two. We clip those out, and we carefully protect and preserve those. And I know more than one or two people that have a lot of evidence of their deaths and marriages and births all in a binder with the family Bible. Some people say, well, John, how do you get a passport? Well, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked. We use the two certifications, the affidavits from a witness and or midwife, et cetera, or an attending physician, and we bring two copies of the of the newspaper. And I've been doing this long enough now that I'm helping some of these people that we've done this with, their grandchildren. I had the honor and the privilege of 4 months ago getting 11 passports for 11 grandchildren in two families in the Tyler, Texas area that originally I got the parents there. I helped them get their original passports. They didn't have any. And both parents were born in the hill country, one in central Texas, the other in Tennessee. And they didn't have a birth certificate. It was not recorded live. But we were able to go and get witnesses to sign affidavits and individuals that they had, doctors and nurses that they had been attending and been attended by for many, many years, so that we could prove that they were natural American or individuals or American nationals. Now, the thing that's important about that is that with Christy and Paul, they had a little chain of food stores that they wanted to start serving liquor, and under Texas law, you to get a liquor license, you must have a socialist insecurity number. I mean, a social security number. And it took us almost 19 months to get that without a social security number. We did fight a little bit in court. They hadn't started offering the wine for sale, and coincidentally, the wine was produced at a friend's winery that they were, you know, to get the liquor license for their little stores, and they were selling Shabbat wine. They were in competition with Mogan David and Manischewitz. But the thing was that it took us a little bit. We had to very carefully and pleasantly and comfortably educate not one, not two, but three magistrates or justices to get to the point where they, you know, literally slap their chin and say, wow, this license thing is wrong. You know, I'm just going to go ahead and make court order. You know, you guys get your Texas liquor license. And the state of Texas was a little bit miffed with it. It started a nasty trend, and Paul and Christy, they eventually agreed to not publicize what they had done in exchange for a dispensation both at the state and the federal level about the alcohol tax being on the wine. And, you know, they didn't walk away with nothing. They, consensus gave them something. But what happened was is that when we were able to prove that they were not under the jurisdiction of the federal government, they weren't required to have the regular requirements of a social security number to get the liquor license. Some of you are probably familiar that a liquor license is almost impossible to get without each and every proprietor or partner in the business without their social security number being online. It's a very challenging and very tough thing to do. Knowing your jurisdiction, and Paul and Christy had and Diva and Bruce and a couple others, they were clean and unscorched by the claims of the IRS and the Social Security Administration. They had been self-employed almost all their life, the thing is that they, when it came time that they had their first brush with the society, as it were, meaning the IRS and the government and Treasury Department, they found themselves as guests, and their seven children, they're guests of Club Fed. But they didn't get excited. They didn't complain. They were very tactful about it. They're very pleasant to the prosecutor, both prosecutors, and by asking questions and being tactful, they ended up with one of the prosecutors still calls Christy up. They go out, they do things with their grandkids together, you know. But this is a prosecutor that was ready to put Christy in a penal institution here in Texas. It's very, very important to learn your jurisdictions. Some people say, well, how many different kinds of jurisdictions are there? It depends on the venue that we're talking about. Now, if you have a criminal case, subject matter jurisdiction is very, very important. Another one is territorial jurisdiction. Another one is personal or in personam jurisdiction. Then there's general and limited jurisdiction and executive or concurrent jurisdiction. Now, that's if you're in the in difficulty with a criminal matter. Now, there's other types of jurisdiction that go even farther, and they divide them up by exclusive federal jurisdiction, concurrent federal jurisdiction, partial federal jurisdiction, proprietary jurisdiction, and those are the ones that in a federal civil or criminal case, mostly federal criminal, that they're going to that they're going to banter. When you're in a civil, you have territorial, personal, and subject matter jurisdiction. Meaning that the thing is that when you're in a civil matter, or actually, civil and criminal, you must have all three: territorial, personal, and subject matter jurisdiction. The court cannot only possess one of those; it must possess all three. Very, very important. And I listened to a bench about 3-4 weeks ago on a Zoom call say, well, we've got personal jurisdiction here, but they didn't have subject matter jurisdiction. And when we brought it up, and when I prompted the lady that was appearing to she's 54 years old, she's a school teacher, the argument on this was the school material that she was teaching, this court did not have either territorial or subject matter jurisdiction. Because one of the individuals was from California, they filed in California, she's teaching in Guam. They did not have territorial or subject matter jurisdiction, but they claimed in personam or personal jurisdiction because she was born and raised in Southern California, but she's the wife of a pilot, and she donates her time to schools in the U.S. Territories and held possessions of Guam. The judge was extremely resistive. He got very upset, found her in contempt. We ended up going through two more hearings before we finally got the jurisdiction issues established. A lot of these individuals don't understand jurisdiction. They believe they do, and if you don't believe me, just ask them. Some of them are the experts on jurisdiction. If you don't believe me, just ask them. And some of them are know-it-alls that can't. They do know something, and they can't wait to show you how much they do or don't know, but they believe that they understand and they have something. This is a trap that you can find yourself running into with an individual on the bench being extremely bold, believably bold, only because they believe their own press. They think what they're doing is right. They believe what they're doing is right. They're certain what they're doing is right. And Your Honor, if you don't believe me, you know, I'm doing right, I've got witnesses to back up my perjury. I mean, my testimony. And, but they're dead wrong. And, at this juncture, what happens is that some of those may be very, very hard to raise the jurisdictional, issue for you. Now, what's extremely important is that, while upper courts, usually the occupant of the bench, the jurist, may have been around the block maybe at least once or maybe even twice or 27 or 3,946 times. They have had more exposure to jurisdictions. Everybody likes to aspire to their Peter principle. I know that sounds awful, but that's literally what it is. And the judiciary are nonetheless the same. They will seek to get promoted until they reach their level of incompetence. And but at the lower courts, some of those justices, there's actually two main, but three kinds of justices there. There's the ones that are happy to serve their local community. They're doing what they're doing and they're enjoying it. And like a black female justice that I met 4.5 years ago, she'd been on that bench for going on 23 years when I met her. She hit her 25 and then decided she was going to retire, but actually didn't do so till this year. When she finishes up on December 1st, she'll have 27 years, and she just enjoyed sitting at that Justice of the Peace Court. That's where she likes it. She's good at it. She knows what she's doing. She knows what she's doing, and she really does know what she's doing. Then there's the second one, the ones that they got that position just because it's the first stepping stone and making up the ladder to getting tenure in a very well-paying position that has retirement benefits that are appealing to that individual. Those, most of the time, like a wet cat inside of a brick wall fence that is clawing its teeth and its claws on rock and cinder block to try to get out of there, they don't care who they step on or claw over. You need to be very careful when you come across those. Those individuals can be extremely challenging, especially if you're at a middle court, lower middle court with them. Then there's the ones that were appointed to those positions by the governor or the whoever, that they're there to serve. They didn't have any alter aspirations. They're serving there because somebody that they know and respected asked them to serve there. And to that end, you'll find that those, unbelievably, are the most inquisitive. I had a court hearing 2 years ago on a tax matter where and some of you are just going to love this when I say this, but it's not as easy as you think. But we were abating and putting to bed a property tax matter, and that they said they had jurisdiction, this and that, and the taxing authority wouldn't produce an accounting, and we had to remind them that they're just hired help, and that this is government of the people, by the people, and for the people, and that if you can tax something, people have the right to own property, and if you can tax a right to the point where if they don't pay the tax, you take away the right, then either the right wasn't a right or the law is being improperly applied. And the lady in there, and I call her a lady because she broke the constitutional oaths of office so many times, but she says, I can just find you in contempt. I says, ma'am, I believe these laws are repugnant to the Constitution. And she says, well, no, just it hasn't gone through any appellate procedure or this or that yet. I says, ma'am, Marbury versus Madison, and she didn't know that statute. And I says, Marbury versus Madison, 1803, first branch 179, anything repugnant to the Constitution is void. And she goes, and he says, well, you got to go through the trouble of submitting that to a justice. I says, ma'am, if it's void from the time it was enacted, there's no judicial process required. And she says, what do you mean? You have to have a judicial review. I says, no, ma'am, if it's void and the highest authority, this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, and during the 8.5 hours that you're working in this courtroom 3 days a week, you're subordinating yourself to a fiduciary responsibility to the jurisdiction of the people that you serve. And she says, young man, and I'm at least 20 years older than she was. And she got really upset and endangered. By this time, the bailiff is standing right behind me, and he's got his hand on my wheelchair. And and I says, could you ask your bailiff to take his hand off my wheelchair? And she says, you're going to. I says, ma'am, please. The federal marshal behind him is about to place him under arrest. You know. And she goes, what do you mean? That's not a federal. And he held up his badge, and he says, ma'am, if it's repugnant to the Constitution, there is no judiciary required. And she believed the federal marshal there, right there. Well, he had his gun out, it was cocked, and it was right at the base of the neck of the bailiff. So he was, you know, and this was the second to last event that I had with this particular John Wayne marshal that we, that used to help out. But she gulped and she says, well, we're going to take a recess. And the federal marshal spouted off and he says, ma'am, until we get a resolution with this, there is no recess. I'm sorry. You know, he says, she says, why? You can't do that. Because you just created multiple felonies in the presence of a U.S. Marshal. Therefore, unless I get clarification that those were not felonies, and he emphasized it with that particular amount of volume, he says, I'm sorry, you cannot leave my sight, and you're technically under arrest now. She says, what? He says, ma'am, I need clarification. Did you just violate this person's civil rights? And bottom line was, she told the taxing authority, all four attorneys for the taxing authority, property tax, that they had to go back and rethink their paradigm. And he says, ma'am, are you issuing an order that they cease and desist, can no longer, that this is done for her? And she goes, why would I do that? And the marshal, he asked her just straight out, that's de facto evidence that you just didn't commit a felony. But if I don't have any de facto evidence, I'm going to have a hard time explaining why if I don't arrest you, why I didn't. She had her law clerk handwrite an order right there, and she signed it. And that particular lady, no longer pays property tax in Texas. And she does not have a lodeal title on that property. There's a whole bunch of other things. That tax case was handled completely. That was a toughie. In the particular situation in the courtroom, we proved that they did not have jurisdiction to tax her to take away those rights. The rights that were given were not under the state or the federal government's jurisdiction. It was under God's jurisdiction. And when we finished up, thankfully, everybody in the courtroom did realize that it was under God's jurisdiction. And so when we were able to prove that she did not have, that court did not have subject matter jurisdiction, and the court, when we challenged subject matter jurisdiction, this court hears all the property tax cases in this, and she overruled it just like that. And this one was less than 5 years ago, and she overruled I raised my hand and I said, ma'am, the issues of subject matter jurisdiction is not necessarily whether this court hears a tax case. It's whether this individual can be taxed, and that this state and county authority has the legal jurisdiction to tax her. She says, what are you muddying up the water? It's just very simple. We have subject matter jurisdiction. It was tough. The courtroom, the verbiage in there was thick enough to cut, it was like split pea soup. It's very, very important that the first jurisdiction you want to look at is personal or in personam jurisdiction. If somebody doesn't have, the Ninth Criminal Court here in Houston hears over half of the unlawful carry or unlawful weapons charges or firearms or guns, and did for many, many years. They still hear a few, but we tactfully and pleasantly, after the third judge retired because they realized that they were coloring outside the lines, and now that there was no statute of limitations on what they had done. Two of the three live in non-extradition countries now, and they've taken their retirement. They realized the gravity of the situation. We didn't threaten them. We were very tactful. We educated them in a very pleasant and very kind manner, and they all of a sudden decided that they could no longer deal with this. I'm going to I'm going to grab something to drink here for a second. Okay. But the subject matter jurisdiction is the second most critical, and it's actually just as critical as territorial jurisdiction. And GW makes an excellent case on territorial jurisdiction. And Michael, while doing my introduction there, he gave you, whether you realize it or not, almost a soup to nuts on territorial jurisdiction. Very, very important. You know, when Michael is introducing one of the information providers, or like myself or GW, one of the others, or Bernie, or Justice Breshears, some of the things that Michael shares, you would not believe how golden those are. And so I would encourage you that during the introductory time periods when Michael is, paving the road for the information provider that's coming on next, Michael is very straight. He shoots straight, cuts a straight path. And when he says something, it's not because he's guessing at it, but Michael, if you stop and think about it, I'm an information provider. You know, there's been many others, Tony, and going way back, where individuals are just constantly sharing what they've learned in the facts of law and of jurisprudence. Michael has had the honor and the privilege of hearing every word of it. And to that end, all week long, he listens to every word. When we research the technology of law, and we're able to learn something, we come up with it. Michael has the benefit of all of that purview. So the thing that's extremely important is that without exception, I have come to the place where I don't banter anything that Michael may have something to contribute on, because Michael, it's an unbelievable blessing. He hears everything so much, so well, so wonderfully. And to that end, Michael's bringing out some facts, or findings of law or conclusions, or especially the case sites, please always listen to that. Because Michael covered the jurisdictional issues at the beginning of the call on the territorial, right now we're going to go now to the subject matter. There are certain magistrates and certain courts that have subject matter jurisdiction that is exclusively what they do. But if any case is going to be heard, it's very, very important that bring up subject matter jurisdiction, it's the thing that's vitally important is that is very simple. It's the requirement that the given court has the power to hear the specific type of claim that you brought into that court. And if we're in a federal court, and I'll use Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 12A6, which says you must bring a claim for which relief can be granted. And so that when you bring a claim into that court, they have to have jurisdiction. We did a bummer of a claim. We went to federal court on, I'm just going to give you the 40,000 foot on this. I'm not going to go into any specifics. But during the 2020 election, we actually got to the place in U.S. District Court where we had a judgment against AH that she wasn't qualified to serve as vice president. She's not a natural born citizen. The term natural means the product of two U.S. citizens, meaning that both citizens were either a natural or naturalized. But to be a natural citizen, what's happened is that after 1823, everyone has to have or be a natural citizen to serve as president, or vice president, or in a capacity that could roll up to the presidency without disqualification for lack of being a natural citizen. We had a default judgment. Well, we still do have a default judgment against her. Here's the problem. The federal government has no jurisdiction over the qualifications of an applicant for a job or office. The federal government has zero. Those are all held by the state. In this particular one, we realized that, the U.S. District Court, even though it was in the state of California, the Southern District for San Diego, where the case is, and we still have standing in that particular case. What happened was that we couldn't enforce the judgment because we realized after the fact that the court, even after we got a judgment in our favor, in our behalf, against the vice president. And this is less than 24 calendar. Actually, this will be 24 calendar months next month that we filed that. We filed before the election. In 3.5 weeks, it'll be 24 calendar months that we filed that. And we could not enforce the judgment because technically, and this is after the fact, the U.S. District Court did not have subject matter jurisdiction on this particular case. The state has jurisdiction, and this one actually has to be in the state superior court in the state of California. That's the right place, and that's the all farther I'm going to go on this. But suffice to say, even after we had a favorable judgment, or excuse me, let me rephrase that, a judgment in our favor of all those filing, and we filed withstanding his class when we filed that. Legitimately, we could not get the judgment enforced because it was the wrong court. It's very, very important that when you get a claim that or you seek to make a claim for which relief you believe the relief can be granted, it's very important to go into the correct jurisdiction. One of the issues about correct jurisdiction is that you must exhaust all the legal lower court legal remedies. And while an upper court may carry a jurisdiction eventually, in many cases, especially if you have a property dispute or a marital dispute, or a divorce case, you can't waltz into U.S. District Court with a divorce case. They don't have the subject matter jurisdiction. At that point, they may have territorial jurisdiction, but they don't yet have personal or in personam jurisdiction because of the fact that you have not exhausted all of your lower court remedies that can bring you up to that. Now, conversely, going back to a little bit on Michael's moment on territorial jurisdiction, there are certain cases where, like this this one person, his wife just didn't want to be married anymore, and she went to a local court and got a divorce decree against him, and the difficulty when it came to this one was that we actually filed a case in a brief that the church that they got married, they agreed would always be the if there was a dispute in the marriage or they needed counseling or there was any divorce, that the church where they got married was where they were going to have it out, as it were. The difficulty was she forgot about that. She went into a state court, got a judgment, got most of the assets, and we filed to say that this state did not have jurisdiction. There was a higher court that. And it was the Beit Din or the religious court that was involved with the church, and the commissioner that heard that case was very reluctant. It wasn't until we made it clear on her that there was a deprivation of civil rights under color of law, and that in the process of seizing some of the assets, the husband was badly injured, and that now it constituted a federal criminal felony under 18 U.S.C. 242, and that she was an accessory. When she heard those very words, it was, she said, "Excuse me," and I says, "Ma'am, what are you asking for?" I called her ma'am, and she goes, "Just give me a couple minutes here," and I says, "I can't leave." She says, "I'm not asking you to leave," but she typed up something right there, signed it, and had the clerk stamp it, and overturned her decision on the divorce and said all those proceedings were void, and she ordered the wife, she had an order that if she came back to that court for anything until exhausting the remedies with the church, that she would be put in custody for contempt. Jurisdiction, we've just started to cover this, the 40,000 foot. I've given you a few word studies and case examples to try to give you some some level of practical conversion and understanding of jurisdiction. Jurisdiction is one that one topic that we could spend 2 to 3 weeks of every night, 2 hours a night, on, and barely get to the place where we've got a reasonable working understanding of it. And so to that end, and I say that because all the years that I've been studying jurisdiction, I've learned so much more that I learned that I don't know and that I need to learn more, and that how much I know begins to pale in comparison each day further, further every day, that I realize how much I don't know. So with that, we're going to, I'm going to turn it back over to Michael for Q&A. Remember, we prefer, the question and answers, address the subject, matter topic of the evening. There is no limitation on that. So if you feel free, you know, if you want to, feel free to ask whatever question you, deem necessary. Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome, and thank you. Thank you for those kind words. You know, I got to thinking about all those nice things you were saying about me, and I think I'm entitled to a raise, so we might have to read
it. You mean talking about you behind your back in front of your face?
Yes. All right, anyways, I'm not going to change the subject for tonight, but when you brought up subject matter jurisdiction, I kind of got a grin on my face, and I'm thinking of something that I was taught first almost 30 years ago, was to say to the court, and this is traffic. I liked traffic court. It was home. It was a place to practice and learn. Is to say that I do not understand the nature and the cause of the charges against me. And I'm bringing it up now, not for discussion, but to plant a seed for something for you to topic on, you know, sometime in the future. Okay?
Right. Did everybody understand the gravity of what Michael just said? They cannot prosecute you unless you understand the charges. And to that end, sometimes they'll try to refer you for psychiatric assistance.
And that's exactly what happened. I kept, no kidding, I had a customer of mine in my business that was a psychiatrist. In fact, he was a who's who psychiatrist in our county. And I would keep and maintain from him after my first lesson a letter current that said that as of this writing, Michael Edward is of sound mind and stable and whatever language he used, et cetera. And I would keep that with me in court, because when it would come up, I'd say, Your Honor, would you like to look at this? So, it's
yeah,
true.
You know what? All the way from 1976, after I got out of the Air Force, to 1991, I used to keep the same letter, because mm-hmm. some of the justices in Southern California, they were very quick to, and especially in Utah, they're very quick to play the in capacity card.
Baker Act.
Okay.
Baker Act. Yep. Yeah, and then once you get in there, then they have a syringe with your name on it and introduce all sorts of chemicals to your body. So press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Press star 2 to raise your hand to ask a question. We've got Michael first, James next, second, and then we'll see who follows them. Press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. I will then unmute your phone, and you're free to engage with John here. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, simply look to the center right of your monitor. You'll see a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty. Left click inside of it. Type away your comment or your question. Outside that rectangle, underneath to the right, is a place to put your name and some other contact information, if you'd be so kind. Then hit submit, and I will be happy to give voice to your comment or your question. So we start with Michael. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, good evening, everybody. I got three things real quick. The last one, the divorce case. I believe the judge realized that she put herself into a contractual dispute that she was ignorant of, and the defendant, the one that brought the case, didn't expound on it, and the defendant wasn't able to immediately proceed on it. But if that's the case, and they had a religious contract, ecclesiastical court, then she put herself in a position that it would be damaging to her. But the next one is Kamala Lala there. She put a guy in jail in California and when she was DA, and she manufactured the evidence against him, and it's still on the records. And yet they selected her to go with Joe. But if you take any action before the election here and before January, and Nancy's out, she would be, if they removed her like in November, December, Nancy would be vice president. God help us then. And third is the Guam. You said the woman was from Guam, had something to do with Guam, and her husband was a pilot. Well, World War II, right after World War II, they started recruiting teachers from the states, the lower 48, to go to Alaska and Hawaii, and this is all in the records. And they had to, because those were territories, they had to give them tax-exempt status because apparently those people knew what the law was, and they didn't pay no federal income tax when they were teaching in those two states. So there's a lot to dwell on there. And that's about it for tonight, brother.
Well, thank you for those comments. There's in almost every state there's stipulations that you must exhaust all of the other remedies that are available to you, lower remedies or higher remedies in certain cases, before you proceed into court, before they'll accept jurisdiction. And when it comes to subject matter jurisdiction, they break the jurisdiction up into multiple categories, like federal question and diversity. And if it's complete diversity, you know, then the type of citizenship comes to play, and that's where we GW. And I encourage, while I could retrace a lot of GW's path there, I encourage everyone to please sit on GW's call, because when it comes to subject matter jurisdiction under diversity and types of citizenship, and you've probably already figured out we're just barely scraping the surface there, that when it comes down to types of citizenship, it makes all the difference on the subject matter jurisdiction. Also, in personam jurisdiction, they have long arm and constitutional, but immediately beside that, in almost every state and the federal government, they have a definition of contractual agreements that produce jurisdictional steps, that meaning that you have to exhaust that before you get to it. In that wedding or that marital dispute, there was no exhausting of that. And there's a lot of places where we can show you contractual issues that transcend a state's jurisdiction to complain about you. Thank you. My humble apologies. I got something caught in my throat here. Or my throat's kind of dry. Back to you, Michael. Michael, you there?
It helps if I am mute.
Oh. Don't confuse me with the fact that
I'm just sitting here rambling on. Anyways, Las Vegas, you got any other questions or comments?
No, that's it. That's it. It's interesting. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next is James. Go ahead, James.
Or
as I like to
good
refer
afternoon.
As I like to Brilliant. Refer to him as Sweet Baby James.
How you doing, Mike? John.
I'm doing all right.
And everyone else. Again, John, the subject was beautiful and how you explain the jurisdiction. And I have actually you brought something up about tax, but I want to talk a little bit just to give you some facts or stuff that happened to me. And I was just trying to find a remedy and which way I should go. In December 24th, 2021, I was in my vehicle and I got hit by a car that ran through the stop sign about 55 miles per hour, pushed up on the sidewalk. I paid my insurance in advance. They're saying because they haven't paid me, my vehicle is definitely total, and they haven't paid me for the accident. And but my insurance is paid up. I paid it in advance. And I'm still, and I'm also taking them to court for I had an injury in the car because I hurt my knee. It was slight fracture. We're supposed to have a deposition on that on this past Monday, but they canceled it. So I guess what I'm asking, with this insurance not paying me my, let me digress a little bit. I had two vehicles on the policy. They didn't take the other vehicle off. They're trying to say that I didn't live. Oh, they couldn't find the address I lived at because my address, my license is in Maryland. I live in Michigan. They were trying to find out exactly where I lived at in Ann Arbor, Michigan, or whatever the case would be. But I gave them the address where I lived at. I use that address. And I always have, even when I was in college at the university up there, I always used that address, basically. So they don't want to pay me, but they never took the other car off the policy until the policy ran out. So I was just trying to find out, is there a remedy? Is there a jurisdiction questionnaire that the insurance company doesn't, how can I make them pay me or have them pay me possibly? And do I talk to them about in the deposition when they do reschedule the deposition? Is there anything that I can make them pay attention to? Get a remedy for anything.
Now the insurance company, let me see if I understand you and correct me if I'm wrong. I'm going to paraphrase this back to you so that that we both have some legitimate understanding that, the clarity that I understand what you're saying. They're saying, the insurance company is saying that because they could not find your address, they didn't want to pay you. Is that correct?
Right. Yes, basically that's what they're saying.
Okay. Is the address that was on your policy get your actual address?
No, not really. It's not really my actual address, but I don't have, that's the address I was using up in Ann Arbor. I mean, because my address is, I have an address that I have in Detroit also, but they looked at one of my other houses that I had, but I didn't live at that house. I don't live at the house. I left that house in 2017, 2016. So I didn't have that house, but my state ID has that license on it. I move around a lot. I had some female friends I was staying with also. And so I didn't really change my address. I just left everything as it is.
Okay. The insurance companies use a rate analysis calculator that factors in your location, where you live, the area that you might drive in, and they have in this rate calculator, what happens is that they grind in the accident rate in that particular neighborhood or that city or that freeway that you would drive to work. And they make their projected potential loss projections, and they do their risk analysis for each individual. These are just some of the factors that they use for the risk analysis that gives them the factor that they're going to charge you for a monthly or yearly premium. Right now, if you go to Progressive, State Farm, and a couple of others, and Geico, it'll say in there, it's written into the contract, you know, that failure to provide your correct address constitutes attempt to obtain a false coverage under false pretenses, and attempting to make a claim under that also can be considered a fraud. And in certain cases, if it's over $3,000, it's a felony. It's a state mm-hmm. felony. I'm particularly aware of this one because I and my family are not a white picket fence family. I may have worked for the government at one point, and after I got out of the Air Force in 76, I'm an instructor pilot and for the FAA, and I still have I haven't done much of that lately. I still have a current instructor pilot certificate. And we live in airports. We were living in an airport when my son was born. And to that end, there's no address there. And the FAA is one of the people that is the most stringent on having your exact physical address for a certificate. And it took me a few years to help them understand, back in the late 70s, early 80s, that back then I was single, but I was living in airplanes and air bases, and I didn't even have a regular condominium or apartment or a house mm-hmm. for a while there. And I just says, look, I work for our uncle, and it's you're saying that, you know, if I go tell our uncle that you don't want to provide me the regular services, amenities, and privileges and rights of citizenship here because you can't put physical address, you can't pin me to a physical address, and the fact that most of the places where I put my head at night, this is back in the 70s and early mid 80s, don't exist. Not on a map, not on a chart, and you can't look it up, and even to this day, you can't look up the addresses because they don't exist. You know, and, mm-hmm. I says, so to that end, you're going to deprive me of my, instructor pilot certificate, which is part of what I do for our uncle, you know, and, I had to appear before a Senate Oversight Committee and explain myself. And I actually had to appear before a committee that had to be first vetted and all have clearances. And they were very upset about that. But when they finally realized what I may have done for our uncle and who I was, they were very pleasant and compliant about it. That was the first step in a huge understanding that a lot of times people don't understand things. They ignorance breeds contempt breeds fear. Except in your case, not having the address, there may be a good reason why you don't have, you may not post your regular physical address. You may not have one. You've been asked, Michael, my family's absolutely not a white picket fence family. Things have, been creative at the very least for us. But there are some things, if you've got a challenge like that, I've always found a way to work it out with the people involved, explain how and why something was like that. Now, they could be claiming, just saying, well, this guy's committing fraud and he was just looking for a lower interest, premium, by having this address or that address. They may, by not pushing it any farther and not having you prosecuted for fraud, they're doing, in their mind, doing you a favor. So what happens is you need to educate them. You need to find out, what the question is. It's hard to give an answer without knowing the question. And
right.
Why? The question is why they do not want to pay. Do you already know why? Are they just giving you some kind of answer and saying, well, it's an address issue. You know why?
Well, yeah, somewhat. And I have to review them papers again. And I can always send them to Mike if I don't get it right. But they're saying that because they're asking me about the address in Detroit. And I said, they asked me who lived there. And I said, I don't live there. So they didn't have, I said, I used to live there. And again, as I stated a moment ago, that's on my Michigan State ID. But I have a Maryland license. I never changed my Maryland license because I had a driving school in Maryland. And then so they didn't really have a physical address for me. And the purpose of me doing that really is because I really, as Mike already know, I don't really want to be on the grid. That's the bottom line. I'm trying to get off the grid. But they didn't really have a physical address of that they could catch me at. I mean, they could go to that address and the person that's on there, they don't say, yeah, that I know him, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't live there, and I didn't tell them I didn't live there per se. I just told them that was a relative house, which it is indirectly is my niece's grandmother's house. So I always use the address, but I never gave them any other address unless it was a P.O. box. I gave them a P.O. box. So they asked me to get a couple of things for them. Like they wanted to, one of my cars is in my business name, but, I realized I didn't have it, for my other car that got hit. I was supposed to put it under the trust, but I did this. I bought my daughter a car, but in return, I bought another car, but I put it in her name, the Lexus, I put it in her name. So that's the other part of it was too, cause it was in her name, but I paid the insurance and I paid the car. No, she never paid anything. And she lives in Philadelphia. So I know it sounds like a ball of confusion, but, it was just part of my trying not to be on the grid, more so than anything. But, I was just trying to find a remedy to see if that was anything possibly I could do or send to them to, cause really we have a deposition, but it's for the injury, but it's not for the payment of the car. So, I don't know. That's where I'm at.
Yeah. I am. that's a little bit of a tough one there. When you're not and I use the term a white picket fence family, meaning that mm-hmm. there's a standard demographic that right now, and as strange as it's going to sound, it's the computer programmers, the coders that are creating the mold that they want everybody to fit into because mm-hmm. everybody's, the information age, everybody wants to to eat at that table of the convenience and the information. And to that end, the gentlemen writing the code are the ones that are figuring out how to do it from scratch. We, the unwilling, led by the unqualified, have been doing so much with so little for so long, will now attempt to do the impossible with absolutely nothing. They live their lives in glass jars. They don't, in little cubicles, 6x6 or 8x8 cubicles.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have any, some of them do not have any connection with reality. And the reason I know this is my, one of my brothers, he is the, he just retired as the chief head of the Artificial Intelligence Division for what was a consortium of academia between NASA, Boeing, and North American Rockwell. That was recently, or that was acquired a while back by Boeing. And he and my father were the ones that started the concept of artificial intelligence. And so what happens is that when something doesn't fit the paradigm or can't, the computer can't answer the question like a real person, they exclude you. So what happens is you have to talk to a real person to get your problem solved. And you have to be able to convince this real person that your paradigm is acceptable. It's just they, it may not match their paradigm. And so, mm-hmm. to that end, communication is what this calls for. How long ago was the claim?
The car accident was in December of 24, I mean, 24th, December 24th, 2021.
So this has been about 10 months ago.
Yes, sir.
This is the type of situation that's best handled by good and excellent communication. Okay. You don't have to always tell give all the information, tell all the facts. You can omit certain facts without lying. If you've got something that needs to be protected, I actually did have something that needed to be protected, and of all things, the U.S. government was the one that was doing it for me at the time. But the problem was that they couldn't tell the other arms of the government what was going on. And I still have some challenges with that. I've learned that you can solve problems like this with good communication, but you have to know what the bottom line is. What are they looking for? By the way, how much is the settlement?
I haven't gotten the settlement yet. Again, the deposition was for the injury was supposed to take place Monday, but it didn't take place. They canceled it. And for the car accident itself, or the car being total, they just closed the case out. They're not dealing with that part yet. So I needed, they told me they couldn't even talk to me. That I had to get a lawyer, and I was really trying to handle it to myself. But I forced myself to get a lawyer to help me. But I mean, it's a group, a law group called Siegel Law Firm. Siegal. So, money talked about it, anything like that. It's just that the deposition, I guess, is supposed to handle all of that and going to the injury about me being injured in the vehicle. And going to the doctor, that's what was supposed to take place Monday. But for the car accident, that's a separate case by itself. So I guess sound like I might just have to. I'll try to communicate, but it seemed like I might have just have to eat the bullet on that. But I don't know if they think they was doing me a favor by leaving my car, my other vehicle on there, and. Leaving it on until the policy ended in June, I think the policy ended in June or July. Policy ended in June, the end of June. So I don't know if they left, because they left that on there. But to me, it was really, it was a toss-up, because if I had an accident in the other vehicle, where are you going to pay me? So that was my question. So I don't, in other words, you could have gave me half my money back for what I was paying. The company called Cure, Cure Auto Insurance.
Yeah, this one thing I found out when it comes to automotive difficulties, and like yourself, I've always tried to negotiate mine myself. In the first couple of years of the 30 some odd years I've been married, somebody hit my wife and totaled out the vehicle a couple of times. One question that I always asked the insurance adjuster was, wow, that seems kind of low. I don't know if that'll cover this. Do you think a judge would let you get away with not making me whole again? But sir, your car is this old and yours that, and the maximum. I says, ma'am, that's not the point. This is what it was doing for me. And she says, every time I ask that question, they always turn it over to their supervisor and the manager. And next thing I knew, a check was written.
I get you. I get it.
Thanks.
Okay. Yep, I get it.
I didn't threaten them. I just asked. I said, do you think a judge would let you injure me or your party, your insured, and then not make me whole and not restore me? Do you think a judge or a jury is going to be comfortable with letting you do that?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question.
Okay. Yep. Got it. Well,
take care of yourself there, youngster.
I will. I appreciate it. I would definitely do that. I have another thing, but I'll send it to Mike and about a house for jurisdiction of a house that was taken from me for taxes. But I'll send it over to Mike first, the paperwork that the county sent, sold my house. But the Michigan Supreme Court said that they had to pay. They could keep the house, but the overtures had to be going back to the owner of the house. And now the county is trying to say that they haven't finished ruling on it, which is not true. But they just want to pay.
I'm having trouble hearing you. Could you talk closer to the phone, possibly?
Yeah. Okay. I said I had another question. Well, statement about a house, because you talked about jurisdiction. It brought it up to me. It came up to my. To me to ask the question about, I lost a house for taxes in 2016, and the Michigan Supreme Court said that just recently in the last year, said that you couldn't keep the overages of the house that was sold in the tax auction, but because you had to pay them, to pay the owner of the house the overages. My house back tax was like $4,000 because I wasn't working at the time, and I lost it, and he sold it in the tax auction for $74,000. So I was supposed to get the overages, but now the county is saying that they don't have that, I guess they think I'm ignorant or something. I can't read. They sent me a letter saying that that court decision hasn't been settled yet. And that they're going to get back with me when I let, but that's not true to Michigan. I have the law to I have the everything with the Michigan State, Michigan's Supreme Court said that you can keep the house, but you have to pay the overages to the person that actually owned the house prior. So I was going to send that to Mike, anyway, but, that would be a jurisdiction question, I guess. That's more like a jurisdiction situation too.
Well, actually when any kind of lien sale, whether it's for tax or title, and by title I mean by a mortgage lender, etc., when a property is sold at the courthouse steps, they can only satisfy their own debt, and they must convey the remainders from the auction to the owner of the property from which it was seized or sold from.
Right. That's what the state, that's what Michigan State Supreme Court said, but the county is trying to avoid paying me, and I'm pretty sure a bunch of other people too, and for that same reason. So I didn't know it was something that I could send Mike, and you might want to take a look at it and tell me what it would cost me to look at it to get them. I don't know how.
Yeah, get with Michael on that one. That's a good one.
Okay, I'll do that. I'll send it. I'll find the letter by Friday, and I'll send it to Mike. Okay. Well, John, thank you so much for taking the time out, being patient with me, and listening to my.
Take care of yourself, youngster.
I will, man. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
All right, our last question for this evening is off of Freedom's Radio. Karen writes in, John, in the past, have you ever had any success working with felony convictions? And I'm going to add to that, and would correcting the status be of benefit?
With felony convictions? The felony convictions that I've worked with, there's few and far between on those that I've worked on after the conviction. There's a few of them that we've been able, the ones we have worked with, we've been able to get most of them overturned. There's some types of cases I just, I won't work with because it's an O.J. Simpson event. The reason why Al Collings wouldn't testify at the trial, he refused to because he knew his best friend O.J. was guilty. My brother did all the cabinets in Al Collings' house. He did some of in O.J.'s vacation home up in the hills. My brother did some. But the thing is that it's very, very critically important that if we're going to go after something, that it has to be something that's good, right, and true. And there's another old saying, and I don't know whether each individual I come in contact with daily serves and fears the Most High King, but I count on a lot of grace from the King, and I've got a lot going on with him. And though a man seeks an audience from a judge, or it's from God in heaven that he gets justice. So anybody who wants to try a felony, I got to make sure it's cool with the boss. If you catch my meaning, it needs to play correctly with the Most High King.
Well, what I would suggest is that we have a short conference with Karen, and we'll go
from
there.
That is the next step. We need to find out get the specifics on it, Karen, there are some cases where if we can get, now we use the term correcting our status. That's not really a very complete definition of what's doing. We're correcting the paperwork and the identification in the computer to match what's real. And if we take what's real, get it entered in the computer, and then go back and look at, in certain cases, felony convictions, there are cases where after it was corrected, the status was corrected, that now they could have never even been tried, let alone got a grand jury indictment against them, you know. So there are certain cases, situations where confirming this individual status is of vitally critical importance. Does that answer the question? There's no way to answer the question without having a further conference.
I'm going to elucidate on one part here. My premise is that if jurisdiction is never properly established, because if I correct my status today, I'm correcting it not from this point forward. I'm correcting it nunk-pro-tunk, all the way back to the beginning. And if 20 years ago...
You're just changing, you're showing what it has been the whole way along.
And the truth of the matter is, if you possess a certified copy of your birth certificate, that's government authenticated, self-authenticating evidence of your birth, of where, you know, that you're a Union State citizen, that you're an American national. So if,
right.
you know, you're 16 years old and male and just, you know, testosterone through the roof, and you just do something really stupid with a 12-year-old female, and, you know, you're 16, she's 12, it's not too much difference, you know, from that point. And today, you know, 30 years later, you're still looking at that. You've grown up long ago since then. Yeah, you regret what you did, and it was stupid and so forth, but there it is. And 30 years later, you know, you can't even get a job because of being that felony and so forth. And my argument is, look, you did that, and in a common law, American common law court, you're going to be adjudicated, and you're going to serve your sentence, and when it's over with, it's done. It's no more part of you because you paid your penalty for it. But if it's in a civil court and you're not a civilian per se, you're an American national, then it was void from the beginning. And on that reason and that account alone, one should go after and have it removed. Did you commit the crime?
Right.
Yes, you did. Were you in the right court tried? No, you were not.
Correct. And to that end, none of it is valid.
Exactly. So even though the boss would, as you refer to Yahuwah, is going to sit there, no, that he did a wrong thing. That was a 12-year-old girl. You messed up her life for the rest of her life, possibly. The law is in our land, and according to Scripture, that once you've paid your penalties, it's over with. So,
right.
Anyways, so the argument that Karen is looking to hear you say is that, yes, based on the fact alone that a status has been corrected and acknowledged to be in error all these years, now that it's corrected, you have the leverage to go back and reopen that case. Jurisdiction can be, as the law says, jurisdiction can be challenged at any time. At any time means any time.
Yep.
There's no statute of limitations on a jurisdictional challenge. So this is where Karen is thinking of going, is to hire you to teach her family how to discharge the original charge, to make it void and discharged it. So that's where we are with that.
Roger that.
Okay.
Roger that.
I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. Again, most importantly, to remind you, tomorrow night, brand new speaker, brand new information provider, awesome little tool that he's bringing to the table, which is that, and this is in support of Bernie's golden horseshoe, if you would. If you can't afford the $35,000, if you would, to properly set up a golden horseshoe from scratch, perhaps you could afford $9,500 and have a system in place that will work Well, actually, it'll work forever like that, but it would be best to then, after you can afford it, to bring in the golden horseshoe behind it. So just want to share with you, be on the call tomorrow night, 9 o'clock, same phone number, same pin, same time, just a different speaker, different subject. Until then, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm.